Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Brian Lynn, Anna Mateo, Susan Shand, and Mario Ritter. But first, this report.
The United States has long been considered to be among the best places in the world for higher education. For several years now, the number of international students attending U.S. colleges and universities has reached over 1 million. But the appeal of such schools and life in the U.S. does not end with earning a college degree. In fact, research shows the number of foreigners choosing to stay and work after they complete their studies has risen sharply since 2008. That increase slowed considerably in 2017, a new report found. But experts say it shows no signs of stopping. The report on foreign college graduates comes from the Pew Research Center, an independent research group. The center released its findings in late July. The United States lets foreigners study full-time in the country through the government's F-1 visa program. Most F-1 visa holders are only permitted to work up to 20 hours per week. However, some foreign college and university students are able to hold full-time jobs through what is known as optional practical training, or OPT. OPT is temporary employment and work that is directly related to an F1 student's area of study. International students accepted in OPT are permitted to work full-time for a period of up to 12 months. They can do so either while attending school or immediately after they complete it, but they must find work that relates to their college major.
Pew researchers found that a record 276,500 foreign graduates received work permits through OPT in 2017. That is in addition to the nearly 1.5 million foreign graduates who received OPT work permits between 2004 and 2016. Neil Ruiz is a Pew researcher and the lead author of the report. He says international students' desire to work in the United States is nothing new, but their ability to find jobs greatly increased when the federal government changed the rules for OPT in 2008. At that time, the government decided to let science, technology, engineering, and mathematics degree holders extend their stay. Instead of the 12-month OPT requirement, graduates in these fields were permitted to remain in the country for up to 29 months. This ability to work for a longer period made these international graduates more desirable to employers, Ruiz notes. And it also made STEM degree programs more desirable to international students. STEM is short for science, technology, engineering, and math. Those are the majors of foreign graduates who are staying in the U.S. that have seen the biggest growth, Ruiz told VOA. The U.S. government made employment through OPT even more appealing to international graduates in STEM-related fields 2 years ago. It increased the time limit for such graduates from 29 to 36 months. The two policy changes increased the number of STEM degree holders taking part in OPT by about 400%.
But Ruiz noted that as of last year, the rate of growth of foreign graduates staying in the U.S. to work has faced its largest decrease in 13 years. In 2016, the number of foreigners taking part in OPT grew by 34%. In 2017, that number grew by just 8%. Ruiz notes that in January of 2017, President Donald Trump's administration changed the rules governing the program. The change made it more difficult for graduates by limiting them to working directly for their employer. Before the new rule, those registered for OPT could do work for businesses which had relationships with their employer. Yet, Rajika Bhandari argues that this will do little to stop international students from seeking jobs in the U.S. Bhandari is a senior advisor for the Institute of International Education, which studies and supports international student exchanges. She notes that this is not the first time American policies have increased restrictions on foreigners. For example, the terrorist attacks against the United States on September 11, 2001, led the government to take a much stronger position on immigration. This led to one of the biggest decreases in international students at U.S. colleges and universities in the country's history. But Bhandari adds that it only took a few years for foreigners to start returning. That is because the American higher education system is so widely respected. The same goes for the ways in which the country supports its industries in seeking to explore new ideas and find solutions to the world's biggest problems. Just like native students, foreign graduates want the chance to take part in this by using the knowledge and skills they gain through their education, she says. The U.S. really provides this perfect environment for people who want to stay on and be innovators and really contribute in a meaningful way to a knowledge economy, noted Bhandari.
Still, people leaving their home countries for either an education or employment purposes is not always a good thing, says Brian Callahan. He works with the Borgen Project, a nonprofit organization that fights poverty around the world. Callahan worries about the effects of what has been called brain drain. This is when the most educated and skilled people in an area leave to find employment or continue their education elsewhere. A good proportion of the people who leave don't end up going back for 10, 20, 30 years, he said. So I think it's more a problem of them leaving for education, getting a sense of what their economic prospects could be in a more developed country, and then, for understandable reasons, not really wanting to go back. He argues that by leaving, these people are actually harming their home countries. They damage the local economies by not spending money on local businesses and by not providing tax money. They are also using their skills and knowledge to help companies in other countries instead of setting up businesses that could create jobs at home. Callahan notes it is often the wealthiest people who are able to move overseas. So instead, those people should consider investing in their own education systems, from schools for young children all the way to the university level, he says. That way, those who cannot leave do not miss out on the same chances to succeed. Also, Callahan suggests that people in developing nations should fight against corruption and work to make their countries friendlier to international businesses. That way, those American companies they respect so much might come to them instead of the other way around. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.
Now, the VOA Learning English program, Words and Their Stories. On this program, we explore expressions often heard in American English. And sometimes, we get it wrong. Very wrong.
But to be fair, there are simply some expressions that most native English speakers understand and use incorrectly. The problem with these terms is that over the years, they have been shortened and important words are missing.
Today, we will talk about an idiom that people not only use the wrong way, but the original meaning, the very first usage, is actually opposite from how we use it today. That idiom is blood is thicker than water.
If I ask 100 people what the idiom means, most, if not all, will say that it means family relationships are the most important. The blood you share with your relatives represents a strong relationship. We call these family ties. Water here seemingly represents the connection you have with people with whom you do not share blood ties. And those links simply are not as strong.
First, let's look at the word thick. In this idiom, it does not mean the physical size of something, as in the walls on the house are very thick. Here, the word thick means to have a very close relationship with someone. If you are thick with your best friend, you trust him. You could even say you guys are tight.
When used this way, thick gives us a few other idioms. If two friends are thick as thieves, they are very close and trust each other a lot. When you steal from others and get caught, you will probably go to jail. So it is important to trust the people you steal with. If one rats out the others, you could all end up in jail.
The bond between thieves goes beyond a normal friendship. But for us non-thieving people, it's also important to be there for our friends. If you are a supportive friend, you see your friends through good times and bad. Another way to say this is to see them through thick and thin, or be with them through thick and thin. So the idiom, blood is thicker than water, means family ties are the strongest. That makes sense, right? Well, it makes sense until you hear the whole idiom as it was first written in the Bible. The original saying is, blood of the covenant is thicker than water of the womb. The important words in the original version are the ones dropped over the centuries, covenant and womb.
A covenant is a serious official agreement or promise. Usually, we only use the word covenant when the agreement is important, such as a covenant with God or the covenant of marriage. covenants often involve legal requirements, such as an international covenant on human rights. In our Bible-based idiom, the covenant is between soldiers on the battlefield, so we don't use the term lightly.
Now, the other important word is womb. A womb is the uterus, an organ where a woman carries an unborn baby. The water in the womb protects the fetus as it grows during pregnancy. And when a pregnant woman's water breaks, she will soon give birth.
The English language has other idioms with the word womb. For example, womb to tomb means from birth to death. A tomb is a building above or below the ground where we keep dead bodies. We often use womb to tomb when talking about government policies that protect a person for their entire life.
Another way we say this is from cradle to the grave. A cradle is a bed for a baby, and a grave is a hole in the ground for burying a dead body. So, womb to tomb or cradle to grave are both ways to refer to a person's entire life, but in a more dramatic way. And drama is probably what the rock band U2 was going for in their song, All I Want Is You. But all the promises we made, from the cradle to the grave, when all I want is you.
So, blood is thicker than water actually means that bloodshed on the battlefield creates stronger ties than the water of the womb does, or family ties. Not only are we using blood is thicker than water incorrectly, the current usage is opposite from the original meaning.
But here's the thing. We all use this idiom incorrectly. So if you want people to understand your actual meaning, you may want to use it the way everyone else does.
You mean incorrectly?
Yes, I do. And then you can impress them with your knowledge of the original meaning of the idiom.
Yes, that would be a great dinner party story.
That's a great idea.
And that's our program for this week. But it is not the end of the expressions that we use incorrectly.
There are several of those. So don't forget to listen next week for another Words and Their Stories to learn more.
I'm Brian Lynn.
And I'm Ana Mateo.
They cannot go home again. For many Hondurans forced to return to their place of birth, home means a return to the violence that sent them fleeing the country in the first place. In the neighborhoods where they grew up, bodies are left unceremoniously in areas where workers are putting up buildings. Human remains are often carried away as if they were a load of food. Heavily armed police watch from the back of pickup trucks. They stop to search passersby for weapons, drugs, or signs they have ties to criminals. At home, a crying woman tries to wash blood from the walkway where her relative was killed. For those returning to Honduras, home is a neighborhood ruled by murderous gangs who want money and demand that young men become gang members. They kill those who refuse to obey. These Hondurans cannot go back home, so many seek protection at a shelter for troubled youth in the capital, Tegucigalpa. At the shelter, the young men tell their stories. Alexis, 18, arrived at the shelter 2 years ago after being sent home from Mexico. He says gang members threatened him many times because he would not join them. His mother told him he had to run. Salm, 14, left home after gang members threatened to kill him for refusing to join. He was staying at a shelter in Nicaragua, but that country sent him back. Juice, 15, fled Honduras after his father was murdered. He went to Guatemala, which sent him back. "I can't go back to where I was born," Juice said. "In any case, I don't have any family there any longer." The Associated Press is not publishing the full names of the young men or the shelter where they are staying for safety reasons. Many deported families no longer have a home. They sold everything to pay for a trip north. Now they have nowhere to go, and in many cases, they still owe money for the trip. A woman named Larissa, her husband, and their two children left home after the Mara Salvatrucha gang tried to force her 14-year-old son to join. Years earlier, gang members shot her husband 14 times when he refused to give them money. He survived. Three of her cousins joined the gangs, and all died young. "If you join, you get killed," she said, adding, "That's what happened to them." She and her family reached Mexico, but were sent back to Honduras. They lived with relatives in Honduras's countryside. Her husband found work to save for another trip north. She said she could not move back to her hometown, El Progreso. But she did make a visit to get a copy of the police report she had made about the gang. She hoped it will help the family get asylum in the United States. She said they will try when things are calm. Days later, the family left Honduras to try to reach the United States again. In Tegucigalpa, many children remain at home as long as they can. On a recent day, smiling boys with toy guns make believe they are police and gangsters. When asked who they would like to be, they say the police. Today, it is a game. One day, those boys may have to make a decision whether to join a gang or to flee their homes. I'm Susan Shand.
Habitat for Humanity builds houses for people who would not have the chance to own one any other way. Erica Santiesteban is a single mother of two young children. She helped a group of volunteers build her new home in Mishawaka, Indiana, recently.
I feel like I won the lotto. It means everything. Like, I don't have to worry about where am I going to go next.
Among the volunteers working with her was former United States President Jimmy Carter. Many Americans think of Carter and his wife, Rosalind, when they hear the name Habitat for Humanity. Jonathan Reckford is Habitat's chief executive officer. He notes that the group was started by Millard and Linda Fuller in 1976. The Fullers asked Jimmy and Rosalind Carter to help with one of Habitat's building projects in 1984. That was about 3 years after the Carters left the White House. Since that time, they continue to lend their name and muscle to this international aid group. Habitat's headquarters is in Americus, Georgia, not far from Plains, the home of the Carters. During his recent visit to Indiana, the former president described his interest in the group this way.
Every human being probably would like some excitement in their life, some challenge in their life, some things of which they can be proud.
He added that Habitat answered all those needs for him. Reckford said that when Jimmy and Rosalind Carter got involved, the group had already helped 758 families build homes. Since then, it has partnered with 13.2 million people to build or repair homes. There is really no one that has had more to do with that than President and Mrs. Carter, Reckford said. The Carters were not the only well-known Americans to work on the recent home-building project. Erica Santiestepan noted that two country music stars also volunteered. I'm in a house and I have these amazing people to help me. Garth Brooks and Trisha Yearwood are working on my house. I want them to sign the inside of my walls. Santiestepan is not getting the house for free. She will have to make payments on a home loan, just like other homeowners across the country. But the loan will be affordable. Because she helped build the house, she will pay no interest, something the group calls sweat equity. But the Habitat for Humanity project in Indiana is larger than one home. Joining the Carters, Brooks, and Yearwood were hundreds of volunteers. They were planning to set up over 20 homes near Santiestepan's. Habitat has built more than 4,000 homes since 1984. Jimmy Carter said the thankfulness of homeowners like Santiestepan is a big motivation, keeping him returning to build homes year after year. It just means a lot, Santiestepan said. They have no idea what they are doing for everyone. I mean, they know, but I don't know if they can feel exactly how it feels like. It's a dream come true. I'm Mario Ritter.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.